This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson, visiting KUOW Public Radio in Seattle. The testimonies have been presented.
I tried to yell for help. When I did, Brett put his hand over my mouth to stop me from yelling. This is what terrified me the most and has had the most lasting impact on my life. It was hard for me to breathe, and I thought that Brett was accidentally going to kill me.
I'm not questioning that Dr. Ford may have been sexually assaulted by some person in some place at some time. But I have never done this to her or to anyone. That's not who I am. It is not who I was. I am innocent of this charge.
The questions have been asked, and now we're just waiting for the vote. The confirmation process for Judge Brett Kavanaugh to join the U.S. Supreme Court will continue through the weekend and into next week. There is a lot to dig into this morning regarding that story, and the story is still moving, so we should dive in right away. Joining us here in Seattle at KUOW is C.R. Douglas, a political analyst for Q13 News, which is the Fox affiliate here in Seattle. C.R., welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Also with us is Joni Balter, an adjunct professor at Seattle University and the host of Civic Cocktail, a show on the Seattle Channel. I think some of us could all use a tall, strong civic cocktail right now.
Very strong civic cocktail.
Yes.
Nice to see you today.
Yes, indeed. And joining us from the other Washington, back in D.C., is Ron Elving, NPR senior editor and correspondent. Ron, welcome back.
Good to be with you.
We welcome your questions and thoughts about this fast-moving story or about any of the other stories that have made news across the country this week. Email us, 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. We should begin by setting the scene for what's been going on today. We had expected that the Senate Judiciary Committee was going to vote at 9:30 a.m. Eastern Time on whether or not to recommend Brett Kavanaugh as a Supreme Court nominee to the full Senate. That has not happened. At the beginning of the committee's meeting, a number of the Democrats who were on the committee walked out of the room. Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut put forth a motion to try to get the committee to recommend an FBI investigation. That failed. A number of the senators also put forth a motion to call for Mark Judge, Brett Kavanaugh's friend, who, according to Christine Blasey Ford, was in the room and was part of the sexual assault. They wanted the committee to subpoena him and force him to testify. That failed on a party line vote. And so after both of those things failed, a number of the Democratic senators got up and left, including Senator Kamala Harris of California and Senator Blumenthal of Connecticut. Now, the hearing is still going on. Chuck Grassley just gave his opening statement. He's speaking right now. Senator Dianne Feinstein of California, who is the ranking Democrat on the Senate Judiciary Committee, just spoke, and she pushed back against Republican claims that she kind of kept Professor Ford's story quiet. And that's where things stand right now. At the moment, the vote on Brett Kavanaugh is still going to take place today, but it currently is set to take place at 1:30 p.m. Eastern time. Whether that will occur remains to be seen. We don't know if the Democrats are going to walk back in the room for that hearing or not. Presumably, they would still have a quorum and be able to vote because there are more Republicans than Democrats, and we think they only need 50% plus one. So that's where things stand right now. None of that could be true at the end of this hour. I have no idea. That's where things stand at this very second at 10:10 Eastern time on Friday, September 28th. But while we're watching the rest of that, and some of the Democrats are speaking in the hallway of the Dirksen Senate office building outside the committee meeting, we're keeping an ear on that. We'll bring you clips from what's going on as they become available. But let's back up a little bit to one piece of this fast-moving story. Jeff Flake of Arizona was on his way from the fourth floor of the Dirksen Senate office building down to the second floor to try to get to the hearing. And a group of women confronted him who said they were victims of sexual assault and rape. Here is part of that confrontation. Listen.
I was sexually assaulted and nobody believed me. I didn't tell anyone, and you're telling all women that they don't matter, that they should just stay quiet because if they tell you what happened to them, you're going to ignore them. That's what happened to me, and that's what you're telling all women in America, that they don't matter, they should just keep it to themselves because if they have told the truth, you're just going to help that man to power anyway. That's what you're telling all of these women. That's what you're telling me right now. Look at me when I'm talking to you. You're telling me that my assault doesn't matter. that what happened to me doesn't matter, and that you're gonna let people who do these things into power. That's what you're telling me when you vote for him.
That was part of the confrontation in the elevator with two women, two protesters who prevented Jeff Flake for a time from getting to the hearing. They were literally physically holding the door open as it was buzzing and trying to close. This came soon after Jeff Flake released a statement saying that he would indeed vote to recommend Brett Kavanaugh to become a justice on the U.S. Supreme Court. Ron Elving, let me start with you. Where are we?
We are where Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, insists we must be, which is plowing straight on through, to quote him from 1 week ago today. He has had a mission for decades to remake the federal judiciary. He has had the assistance of the Federalist Society, which is a private group of lawyers and other people interested in the law. It has been the mission of many of the people in the Senate and of several Republican presidents. And this is on the verge of being completed in a real sense by the confirmation of Brett Kavanaugh, cementing a 5-4 committed conservative majority on the Supreme Court. And Mitch McConnell, 1 week ago today, said, don't be concerned about all these allegations. He said this to a group of evangelicals who were meeting here in Washington. And he said, don't be concerned about all this. It's just background noise, and we're going to plow right ahead. And that's what we're doing, despite everything that was heard yesterday in that lengthy and wrenching hearing before the Senate Judiciary Committee. We're plowing right ahead. The committee is going to vote. We have been told that, as you said, Senator Flake is going to vote to proceed with the nomination. That gives us 11 votes for Brett Kavanaugh on the committee today. And that means they're going to turn it over to the full Senate, which may commence the formal consideration of the nomination over the weekend on Saturday, so as to be able to complete it Monday or Tuesday and install the judge on the Supreme Court for the start of the term next week. It starts on Monday. He probably won't be there then, but he can be enrobed and join his colleagues before the week is out.
Yeah, the procedural vote, I believe, is to formally open the debate and then close the debate, would go Saturday through Monday, and then the vote could take place thereafter, either Monday or Tuesday. Joni Balter, let me come to you. I think that the drama of this, we thought, was going to peak yesterday with what we saw between Professor Ford and Judge Kavanaugh. Let's just take that one piece of it and leave today out for just a second, since today is still in motion. I wonder what stands out to you the most from yesterday in terms of not only what the Senate thinks of Brett Kavanaugh, but also what the nation thinks of Brett Kavanaugh.
Well, what I think happened yesterday is the nation saw and realized that what Christine Blasey Ford is saying is real. This happened. But I think what you're seeing is, you know, that the Senate has made a calculation already that it doesn't matter what happens in the midterms. It doesn't matter. Chuck Grassley said, you know, the burden is on her instead of on Brett Kavanaugh. And I think that's kind of backwards, because he's the one seeking the job here. There's no excuse in my mind for no FBI investigation here, even to hear from Mark Judge. I mean, why does he get a pass? Why don't we have to hear from him? The hurry here is because time is not on the side of this nomination.
With regard to the FBI investigation, CR, let me come to you with that. There was a really intense exchange between Democratic Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois, Judge Kavanaugh, and Chuck Grassley, who is the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Republican. It's long, and just so you know, there are some pauses. So if your radio or your stream goes quiet, it's not broken. This is part of what happened. Here is that exchange, and then I'd like to get your take on it. Listen.
You spent 2 years in the White House office that approved judicial nominees. You turned to the FBI over and over and over again for their work. Let's bring them in here and now. Turn to Don McGahn and tell him it's time to get this done. An FBI investigation is the only way to answer some of these questions.
So, stop the clock. This committee is running this hearing. Not the White House, not Don McGahn, not even you as a nominee. We are here today because Dr. Ford asked for an opportunity here. I know you did too as well. In fact, maybe even before she did. We're here because People wanted to be heard from charges that they all thought were unfair, or activities like sexual assault was unfair. So I want to assure Senator Durbin, regardless of what you say to Senator Don McGahn, we're not suspending this hearing.
Part of the exchange between Chuck Grassley, Dick Durbin, and Brett Kavanaugh. And after that, CR Rachel Mitchell, who had been asking questions on behalf of the GOP, was kind of no longer a part of the hearing, and the Republican senators took to making statements of their own. The FBI investigation, is that still a factor?
It is a factor. I thought it was clearly his worst moment yesterday. What you didn't hear in the clip was when Dick Durbin followed up a couple more times and said, should we have... You know, would you support an FBI investigation? And he ultimately just was silent. He had no answer. It struck me that this was an obvious lack of planning. I mean, Don McGahn, the White House counsel who has led this nomination, has been prepping this nominee. He's had weeks, certainly a couple weeks, to realize that question would be asked and what was his answer going to be. I mean, this was a bad lack of planning on the part of Don McGahn and others who were supposedly prepping this nominee. That should not have been a blackout moment.
Much more to discuss as we continue with C.R. Douglas of Q13 News in Seattle, Seattle University Professor Joni Balter, and NPR's Ron Elving. We are watching the latest drama from the Senate Judiciary Committee. Currently a room full of Republicans after many of the Democrats walked out ahead of the vote, which will still take place. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. It's the Friday News Roundup here from KULW Public Radio in Seattle. Joining us this week are Joni Balter of Seattle University and the host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel, Q13 News political analyst C.R. Douglas, and NPR's Ron Elving. We'd love to hear from you about this week's top stories, what seem to be mostly one or two big stories that have kind of captured the news cycle this week. But we'd love to hear your questions and thoughts. So comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A. At WAMU.org. For those of you who are just joining us, we had expected to know, or at least be closer to knowing, whether the Senate Judiciary Committee was going to recommend Brett Kavanaugh to the full Senate in terms of his Supreme Court confirmation. That is not happening this morning. The Democrats have walked out of the hearing room after trying to slow the process down on two procedural grounds. One, asking for a resolution to call for an FBI investigation, and two, asking the Senate Judiciary Committee to subpoena Mark Judge. He's the other guy who Professor Ford says was in the room with Brett Kavanaugh when she was assaulted at that party when they were both teenagers. Neither of those two motions moved, and after they both failed, a number of the Democrats on the committee, not all, but most, walked out of the room, including Kamala Harris of California and Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut, who was the one who asked for the resolution on the FBI investigation. So that's where we stand right now. There are a few Democrats still in the room. Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont is speaking now, and the vote has been pushed back to 1:30. Part of this seems to be moving forward with more certitude because Jeff Flake of Arizona now says he will vote for Brett Kavanaugh to become a Supreme Court justice. And that kind of answers one of the big questions of today. What about the other allegations, Ron Elving? Let me come back to you for a second. There were other allegations against Brett Kavanaugh from two other women, Deborah Ramirez and Julie Swetnick, as well as an anonymous accuser that came forward with claims. None of them was invited to testify before the Senate committee. That came up during yesterday's hearing. Do those claims just go away? What happens to their stories?
Those claims would appear for the moment to be remaining in the dimension of American public life from which they came, which is basically the media. And there will be many media sources for more information about these women. They may continue to campaign, as it were. One of them is represented by the attorney Michael Avenatti, who is famous for representing Stormy Daniels. That particular set of representations against President Trump has certainly had what you would call a lot of longevity as a story. It's gone on, and it is possible that either of these other two accusers will have that kind of life in the media going forward. This is not the sort of attention that is welcomed by the Supreme Court with regard to any of its members. We have had controversies about members of the Supreme Court before. Obviously, Clarence Thomas, who's been there now 27 years, the longest serving justice on the current set. Clarence Thomas was controversial on a similar matter, not sexual assault, but sexual harassment, when he was confirmed in 1991. He has served on the court without generating a great deal of additional controversy. So perhaps all that would die down over many years. But for the moment, at least, Brett Kavanaugh would be joining the court with a cloud over his head that's going to continue, at least in some quarters of the media.
Joni Balter, I was going to ask you about that Clarence Thomas comparison because I could feel that comparison in watching yesterday's hearing for a couple of reasons, not the least of which was the antagonism with which Brett Kavanaugh walked into the room. I mean, Clarence Thomas came in the room having, in his memory, the Robert Bork confirmation. And so he kind of came in ready to denounce the whole process and say this was a sham, used the word lynching twice to describe what was happening to him. And Brett Kavanaugh showed up guns a-blazing, ready to just shoot down not Dr. Ford per se, but the whole process and what he considered this thoughtless character assassination.
So one word here is tone. And when I turned this whole spectacle off really late last night, what came to me as a professional working woman was this feeling that so the woman in this case had to be sort of measured. She didn't have her emotions entirely in check, but she had to be measured. She didn't really lose her cool. But two of the gentlemen involved in this, the nominee, Brett Kavanaugh, and Senator Lindsey Grant, for whatever reason, they're allowed to pop off. Very male, I'm sorry to say that, but it was hard not to notice that they were allowed to sort of become unhinged, and everybody was just like, well, okay, I'm sorry, those kinds of reactions don't look well the next day on when you've seen them.
Well, and that, I'm glad you brought that up because, CR, that raises the question of temperament more broadly. Shad Tree tweeted, even without sexual charges, Kavanaugh proved himself unfit with his bias and belligerence. He is not fit to sit on the Supreme Court of the United States.
I think if you look at both the testimony of Christine Ford and of Judge Kavanaugh yesterday, I think over time his won't age as well as hers. I think he got a short-term pop yesterday when his defiance kind of worked to change the tone of that hearing. But over time, I think it's going to look pettier. I think there'll be a lot of replays of his interaction with Senator Klobuchar and other moments where he just didn't have gravitas. I think, unlike Clarence Thomas, where when the vote was taken, the controversy was pretty much over. In fact, a number of Democrats actually voted for Clarence Thomas. Democrats controlled the Senate at that point. I think we are in such a different political environment that the fight will not be over. Once he gets confirmed, you will have, right after that day, the movement to impeach him. And I think that will be a political issue in 2020 presidential campaign.
Well, see, that's kind of what I'm wondering, just to continue with you for a minute, is whether or not, or how much, that, you know, his comportment in the hearing yesterday really matters in terms of the core political reasons why he was chosen. I mean, how many Americans listen to oral arguments at the Supreme Court? He could cuss every time there's you know, the Solicitor General and another attorney sit before the court, but he wasn't picked for being nice. He was picked for being a constitutional conservative and an originalist, and that's kind of the point of him being there.
But I don't think he was picked to be necessarily the guy that crossed some lines yesterday. I mean, I think the argument about this being a Clinton conspiracy and all that other stuff, I just don't think that will play well over time. I mean, another thing about prep, he didn't have anyone read this opening statement, and I think someone would have toned it down. You could have said, this is unfair, I feel like I'm being unfairly treated. I mean, he could have made the same statement without going into Clinton conspiracy and revenge for Trump. Those arguments are going to haunt him over time.
I believe it was Kamala Harris who asked him if he had listened to Professor Ford's testimony, and he said no, that he was finishing up putting his speech together.
Yeah, he did. And, you know, and one thing about the Clarence Thomas era. That didn't really end the discussion in some ways, because our very own senator from Washington State, Senator Patty Murray, she will tell you, and she's told everybody, that the reason she ran for office was because of what happened in that hearing and how uncomfortable she was with how that happened.
We mentioned that a number of the Democrats on the Senate Judiciary Committee walked out of the room after trying to slow down the process in procedural ways. Here is a clip of California Democratic Senator Kamala Harris speaking moments ago in the hallway.
Democrats are not being heard. They're pushing through this process. And frankly, the statements yesterday were about bullying fellow senators. And from top to bottom, this has been about bullies. Listen to the people. All we have asked for is that there be an FBI investigation. Dr. Ford came in and she poured out her heart. She cooperated with the process. She gave the process dignity and respect. The least we could do is give her the dignity and respect of having a process that has credibility. We are talking about putting somebody on the United States Supreme Court for a lifetime.
That's Democratic Senator Kamala Harris of California speaking moments ago after walking out of the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing. Ron, could I ask you to just give us a little reality check on some of the things the Democrats had been asking for in terms of having the FBI do an investigation, subpoenaing Mark Judge? I mean, there was FBI involvement in the Anita Hill hearing. That's clear. I mean, even Republican Senator Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania questioned Professor Hill about things she said to the FBI that were different than what she said in her testimony. So that has played a role. But how do you view some of these calls for other investigatory tools from the Democrats?
The call for an FBI investigation at this point is in some respects obvious. You would certainly think that if there are questions about this incident from so many years ago, every best investigative tool the federal government has at its disposal would be employed. You would think that the federal government would want to know. You would think that they would want to bring Mark Judge before the committee. You would think that everyone would want this information. There is every reason to want there not to be a cloud over Justice Kavanaugh if he is going to be that next week. So you would think everyone would want that. On the other hand, the argument is valid of saying the FBI does not make conclusions in these investigations. It would come back with a lot of interview material. And that interview material, those reports on what it had learned, might be enormously helpful. On the other hand, they might not. And then you'd be right back where you began. So that was much of the pushback from the Republicans. Don't ask the FBI to do what we here on the committee have decided not to do.
Let me get to some of your comments as well. Alita tweeted, Ford's testimony raised credible doubt over Kavanaugh's character and truthfulness. She wants investigation. He doesn't. Any doubt should lead to a no vote. That's what doubt is for, to advise caution. Any doubt should be counted against this nominee. He is not entitled to the job. Rob tweeted, Evangelical Christian here. I think there needs to be an FBI investigation just to clear the air, though doubtful they could find anything. I think something happened to Ford, but so far her proof is flimsy at best. Herb tweeted, Yeah, I wonder why it's so hard to find witnesses when you're being raped. If only they did it in front of some people. Damn rapists are smart, doing it without witnesses. And one member of the 1A text club writes, The Republicans on the committee are exactly the type of men that wouldn't believe us anyway. I say us because I, too, am a survivor. Thank you for sharing that, all your thoughts, but particularly from the text club. We will be talking more next week about how this hearing has affected people for whom sexual assault or sexual harassment has touched your life directly. And if watching the hearing was personally tough, if it's kind of triggered memories or thoughts, if you deal with people who have been sexually assaulted, helping them deal with what's happened to them, we'd love to hear from you and your thoughts on this hearing. So leave us a voicemail, 855-236-1A1A. How did you reflect on this hearing, particularly if assault touched your life personally? 855-236-1A1A, and we will discuss this further next week. I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Seeley tweeted, Is it fair to say our democracy is in crisis? That's what I see happening with this ultra-partisan Republican agenda. Joni, I see you nodding your head yes.
That's all the the input I'm hearing from friends, how sad they are for our country. What, you know, yesterday was compelling television and radio and all of that good stuff, but it was really a sad moment for our country that it has come to this, that we're blowing past procedure that we would normally do. I'm referring to an FBI investigation. We, you know, we all feel badly about what happened. It was hard not to feel bad in some ways for both folks there. But mostly you feel bad for your country, that we can't handle this with more dignity and more respect for everybody.
Although, CR, earlier in the week we spoke to our friend Jeff Rosen from the National Constitution Center, who teaches law at the George Washington University, and he made it clear that Supreme Court nominations have always been political since Jefferson. I mean, they changed the size of the court, how many people are on it. That was the height of the political game then. So I wonder if this is just the kind of politics we've always had. It just happened to get more personal this time.
Well, listen, our politics, if you just look at the last presidential election, got more personal. So it would be inevitable that this would come through in a judicial confirmation fight. I will say something about the process. I think there is a valid complaint about how this was dealt with when the allegation came forward. We do not have a good system for anonymous complaints. And that is needed here. That is one of the problems here, because Republicans certainly got a lot of mileage out of Feinstein supposedly holding this. There needs to be a procedure. They either need to say, we don't take anonymous complaints, thank you, or we do take anonymous complaints, and here's what we do with them. The ranking and chair take them and they talk about them. You know, they're, you know, do you approve of that? There's a risk of leak. Do you still want to go forward? I mean, I assume corporate America has dealt with this too. Someone probably has a good HR policy about what to do with these. That needs to be one clear reform here, because going forward, this cannot happen again. The process didn't work.
Speaking of going forward, I know we need to move on and talk about a few other things. Two more things worth noting. The American Bar Association sent a letter that says that the Senate should wait to vote until the FBI has investigated sexual assault allegations against him. That comes from the American Bar Association. The president tweeted yesterday during the hearing, it's the last that we've heard from him thus far about Brett Kavanaugh. That tweet read, quote, Judge Kavanaugh showed America exactly why I nominated him. His testimony was powerful, honest, and riveting. Democrats' search and destroy strategy is disgraceful, and this process has been a total sham and effort to delay, obstruct, and resist. The Senate must vote. Ron, could I ask you to react to that, particularly the president's kind of over the last few weeks? I don't know if you've noticed this, too. It seems like the president has been, particularly at campaign rallies, pushing Republican voters harder to elect more Republicans, because if we don't, this kind of thing will keep happening.
That's right. This is a good symbolic issue for the president to seize upon in his campaign this fall to make sure Republican voters turn out. Now, it is part of our political rhythm in the United States that after a presidential election, especially a rather momentous one, there tends to be a certain amount of backwash. 2 years later in the first midterm, the president is not on the ballot, but the people who are unhappy with the president turn out to vote against him, whereas the people who liked the president voted for him 2 years earlier might be a little less motivated. So the president is working very hard to make sure his voters get out to vote for his candidates, if not for him, in November. And this is a big way to do it. This whole nomination has been largely a payback to many of the voters, particularly evangelicals, who did not necessarily have a world of reasons to vote for Donald Trump in 2016, or at least had a few reasons to doubt him. One of the big selling points for them was the prospect of Donald Trump filling 1, 2, 3 seats on the Supreme Court and potentially more. They wanted those seats on the court, and they turned out for him largely on that issue. Many people have established this over the last 2 years, and Donald Trump is still working that vein and working it hard.
A few more stories we want to talk about on the Friday News Roundup as we continue with Ron Elving, Joni Balter, and C.R. Douglas. We will shift gears and talk about the latest with Rod Rosenstein. That meeting between him and the president was delayed on account of the Kavanaugh hearing, and it's easy to see why now that the hearing has happened. We'll also get an update on news here out of the Pacific Northwest that might affect the rest of the nation. The midterm elections are coming up. We'll preview that here in Western Washington and get some thoughts about where Amazon's next headquarters might land. That's all ahead. Stay close. Back now to the Friday News Roundup with C.R. Douglas, political analyst for Q13, Seattle's Fox News Fox Television affiliate in Seattle. Joni Balter, host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel, who also teaches at Seattle University, and NPR's Ron Elving. Let me get to a few more of your comments about the Kavanaugh hearing before we move on. Black Adder tweets, "I believe her. He was way too evasive and belligerent. If it was me, I would demand an FBI investigation. Unless I was guilty." Ronnie tweeted, "This was clearly a Democratic ploy to delay SCOTUS, the Supreme Court of the United States, but necessary because it exposed character flaws such as partisan beliefs, volatility, and emotional instability, things you don't want in a judge regardless of party." David tweeted, "Senator Grassley said, 'I believe Dr. Ford,' just after moving forward with the vote for Brett Kavanaugh. They don't get to have it both ways." A member of the 1A Text Club writes, "Kavanaugh took up Trump University's style. Deny, insult, throw it back at your accusers, in this case Democrats, insert a couple of conspiracy theories, and most importantly, do it loudly." And Jordy tweeted, "I'm tired of people mourning the end of civility in this country. Study the twisted faces of Lindsey Graham and Brett Kavanaugh yesterday, and you see what it looks like when a powerful group, white men, loses power. This is a long-needed and necessary struggle." Joni, let's camp out on Jordy's tweet for a second, then I promise we're going to move on. That Lindsey Graham screed when he says, "When you see Sonia Sotomayor and Elena Kagan on the Supreme Court, tell them I said hello," because I voted for both of them. Between Lindsey Graham being like all, "Rah!" and Brett Kavanaugh being, "Grr!" it was just like this day of angry white guys. Just that piece of it, that really stood out, especially in contrast to Dr. Ford.
I think it really stood out, and I don't think it wears well. I think that as people look at those clips over and over again, you know, you are not confirmed yet to the Supreme Court, so you're acting entitled and indignant, and you're not really answering very many questions about what exactly happened. And all of that together does not make a pretty package.
What about that, though, CR? I mean, how do you see it? I mean, I can understand some of the arguments about the minutia of the process, about who leaked the memo. The reporter from The Intercept who broke the story says he did not get the memo from anyone in Senator Dianne Feinstein's office. I don't believe there's been reporting yet about Congresswoman Anna Eshoo, who is Professor Ford's local congresswoman. She represents Palo Alto, California, because, as Professor Ford said, she contacted Anna Eshoo's office first because Congresswoman Eshoo's office could hand-deliver the note directly to Dianne Feinstein. But does Lindsey Graham, does Brett Kavanaugh have a point in any of their complaints about how this has gone down?
Well, as I said before, I do think there is a flawed process here. What do you do with a complaint that wants to be anonymous? I mean, how do you go forward with that? If you start telling other people and referring it to the FBI, at some point the risk is that it will get out. All of this is going to get out over time. I mean, we will know over time who leaked this. There'll be enough reporting that digs down to that. We will know over time what Mark Judge really knows. I mean, someone will figure this out. I don't know if it's going to be a month, a year, or 2 years, but it's going to all come out. And we're going to get more testimony about his drinking background and that kind of stuff. I just don't think this is over, even if there is not an official investigation.
Speaking of secrets coming out, I'm sorry, one more. Let's get to one more quick tweet by way of transition to our next story. RG tweeted, "Lindsey Graham has called the American Bar Association the gold standard and used their endorsement of Kavanaugh as proof of his qualification for the Supreme Court. Now the ABA has called for an FBI investigation, but it's being ignored. He was correct in declaring this a sham, but it is not at the feet of the Democrats. Meanwhile, President Trump withholds the firing of Rosenstein until he finds out whether or not he has an advocate on the court. Kavanaugh's partisan tirade alone disqualifies him for this position." Let's shift gears and talk about Rod Rosenstein. And so as not to distract from yesterday's events, President Trump rescheduled his meeting with his embattled attorney general. It's been a long week, so let's just recap. On Monday, reports surfaced that Rosenstein had resigned verbally or been fired. A few days before that, the New York Times reported a source who claimed that Rosenstein talked about wiretapping President Trump to gather evidence to see if the 25th Amendment could be invoked. That's the part of the Constitution in Section 3, I believe it is, 3 or 4, that allows for the removal of the president if he is unable to perform his duties. When George W. Bush had surgery, for example, he wrote a letter invoking the 25th Amendment saying, Dick Cheney's in charge until I'm out of anesthesia. Anyway, Rosenstein denied that report, but on Monday, it seemed one way or another that he was out of a job. Ron Elving, what happened? Are we any clearer now on whether there was evidence just with the firing, whether he was ready to walk away from his job or whether he was about to be fired?
He does not seem to have been ready to walk away in the sense of a resignation, but it does appear as though there were moments at least in which, at least emotionally, President Trump was ready to fire him after reading of this report of his talking of wearing a wire and so on. Now, that dates back to the days immediately after President Trump had summarily fired, the director of the FBI, James Comey. And there was a great deal of consternation in the Department of Justice over this. They were taken aback and they were wondering what was going on and whether or not the president was, on the rails. So there was a discussion, apparently. There were memos written about the discussion. It is not clear at all how serious Rosenstein might have been at that time in making the suggestion. If he made the suggestion of the 25th Amendment, he denies it. He says he's never seen anything from the president that would rise to the level of the 25th Amendment. So we have another he said, someone else said, memo said situation. But President Trump has been back and forth all week about just how angry he is about all of this. We can imagine one Donald Trump being extremely angry. But the president in his news conference seemed to back off a little bit and say, well, let's see. We'll see. We'll talk to him. I'm going to talk to him on the phone. He's going to come by. We're going to have a meeting next week and we'll see. So it's up in the air. Perhaps he's waiting to see if Brett Kavanaugh gets confirmed on the Supreme Court first. Perhaps he's waiting to see what else might come out. And meanwhile, the House Republicans, who are very interested in something just before the election to help encourage their voters to come out, are looking to bring Rod Rosenstein in on the carpet and calling on him to come in and talk to them. The House leadership has allowed the House Freedom Caucus, which is their most conservative, hardcore group, to call on Rosenstein to come talk to them about this memo and his loyalty to the president.
C.R. Douglas, what is your sense of what the fallout would be like if Rod Rosenstein lost his job? Maybe it's different whether he was fired or whether he resigned, but what kind of fallout are we talking about, potentially?
I think it's huge. Listen, this is why it's not happening, because the midterms are just a couple weeks away, and this would backfire. And we know it'll backfire because of what happened with Comey. The last time he tried to fire someone, or did fire someone, who was overseeing his investigation, he took all kinds of incoming for that. That's probably the worst decision he's made as president.
And he got Robert Mueller.
So if he gets rid of Rod Rosenstein, he just feeds Democrats an issue for the upcoming midterms, which is you are yet trying to obstruct justice one more time. And I think someone got to him and said, don't do this before the midterm.
Speaking of the midterms, we should talk about the midterms here in Western Washington. But first, let me get to two of your comments about Rod Rosenstein. Green Tello tweeted, if the New York Times is so-called fake news and a, quote, dishonest and failing publication, why would the president believe what they published about Rosenstein? And Raisin Dieter tweeted, I've said it before, but you don't need to wiretap Trump to show mental instability. Just schedule more press conferences. We actually had a conversation on this program about kind of opining about the mental health of someone you've never diagnosed. Fascinating discussion. You'll find it on our website, the1a.org. Joni, let's talk about the midterms, particularly Washington State. It has one of the roughly 60 congressional districts around the country that some say could flip to Democrats. The 8th congressional district has never sent a Democrat to the House. What's in play, Joni, this time around that might change that?
Well, the national politics are certainly in play in the 8th District. This is one of 23 seats that Trump lost but elected a Republican. But the polling, and the New York Times was doing this sort of wild and weird live poll here. The polling shows this to be a complete dead heat. It's too close to call, and national voters are about to find out how slow we count ballots out here in Washington State. It takes forever. This race, so you have a well-known former state senator who's run for statewide office three times and lost, but he has a ton of name familiarity, Dino Rossi. But he is being challenged by a female doctor, and my understanding is she would be the only doctor in Congress if elected. And guess what? Everyone's talking about health care. And they're talking about health care because it turns out health care and, you know, worry about being kicked off of it with a pre-existing condition is kind of a big deal to all the voters. And so this is really a very close race. And it could easily flip.
We should note the 8th Congressional District is east of Seattle, kind of southeast of Seattle, cuts into part of Mount Rainier National Park. The Okanogan-Wenatchee National Forest kind of makes its way further east from the Seattle-Tacoma area. Another hot topic here in Washington and in other parts of the country. I'm sorry, CR, I should actually have you respond on the 8th Congressional
District. Well, one thing I wanted to say is it's got a lot of suburban parts to it. And this makes it a very interesting race to just think about what's going on nationally. A lot of women, a lot of suburban educated women, and that is the cohort that is most fleeing the Republican Party this year. So this is a seat that, as you said, has never been won by a Democrat. In any other year, it would be basically a shoo-in for the Republican, and that the Republicans are on the defensive in this kind of district is telling about probably how the midterms are go, and is very similar to what's happening in lots of districts like this around the country, especially women.
I'm Joshua Johnson. You're listening to 1A. Ron Elving, how do you view Washington's 8th Congressional in light of the other districts that some say might flip this November?
This should be a laboratory for the effects of the hearings on Brett Kavanaugh, for the effect of the changes that the Trump administration has been making to the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare. And there are a number of other places around the country where dissatisfaction with how that law is currently working are attaching to the Trump administration, much, of course, as unhappiness about that law attached to the Democrats in 2010. So what goes around comes around to a certain degree, and this is something that we're hearing about in many parts of the country. But because it's a suburban district, because you have a woman candidate against a well-established male personality, because you have a doctor who is running, all of these things that are national issues are perfectly represented in that really pretty heavily suburban 8th district, which is a classic Republican district, really not just for Washington State, but for the whole West, for the whole country. This is a typical suburban Republican district, and that's why it's so interesting to watch in this environment with these big news stories right now.
Yeah, you've got Democratic candidate Dr. Kim Schreier running against the Republican Dino Rossi in this case. Let's talk about two behemoths that are important to folks in Western Washington, starting with Amazon. Around this time last year, it announced plans to open a second headquarters. Hundreds of regions across North America started vying to be the home of what some call HQ2. CR, you have a theory that HQ2 will end up somewhere in the Washington, D.C. area. Why?
I do, because if you look at the finalists, there are 20 finalists, and three of them are in the D.C. metro area, one in D.C. proper, one in Northern Virginia, and one in Maryland. So they are clearly focused on that. And I think the reasons are pretty obvious. You know, the biggest challenge for Amazon going forward is not necessarily another retailer. It is the federal government and the breakup antitrust potential. So if you put 50,000 employees in the metro DC area, you're going to have 1 or 2 degrees of separation to all kinds of people in power. I mean, an employee is going to be married to a Senate aide, and an employee is going to have an aunt at the Federal Trade Commission. I mean, you suddenly immerse yourself into the powers that be in D.C., and you help inoculate yourself from intense, harsh government intervention.
Joni, depending on who you ask here in the Seattle area, being near Amazon is a good thing or a bad thing?
Absolutely true. So, you know, look, Seattle embraced Amazon for a long time, but the growth and some of the headaches from adding 45,000 employees times husbands and families and all of that good stuff has just made this place extremely expensive and crowded. And so, you know, when I believe when HQ2 is selected, and I agree that it'll be DC for all the obvious reasons, Jeff Bezos has a house, he has a little newspaper over there, that kind of stuff. For all those reasons, I think in Seattle, there will be this sort of psychological letdown, even though folks are annoyed by them.
Before we go, we should talk about one other kind of behemoth that's very important to the Pacific Northwest. Here's what it sounds like underwater. That is an orca. The Pacific Northwest has long been home to these black and white killer whales, but their numbers have declined to a 30-year low. They've been on the endangered list since 2005, and marine biologists fear they could become extinct. Before we go, CR, the Washington State Governor's Office issued this draft report with recommendations to prevent extinction. What are some of the solutions before we go?
Well, the problem is that the solutions are going to be very hard to implement because it affects every walk of life literally around here. I mean, they need to replenish the salmon runs. That's a tough thing to do, especially in warmer waters, which seem to be what's happening over time. And secondly, they want to reduce noise and boat pollution. Well, good luck getting the boats out of Puget Sound, but apparently the tankers, boats, even small craft actually interrupt the echolocation system of these whales, and that is the system they use to feed, so it kind of messes with them. So the very lifestyle of people around the Pacific Northwest is really what is hurting the orca population.
C.R. Douglas, a political analyst with Q13 News here in Seattle. C.R., thanks for spending the hour with us.
My pleasure.
Joni Balter, an adjunct professor at Seattle University and host of the show Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. Thanks, Joni.
Thank you. Great fun.
And NPR senior editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Thanks, Ron.
Thank you, Joshua, and greetings to my family there in Puget Sound.
Many thanks also to Puget Sound's own KUOW Public Radio for hosting us these past 2 days. We thank you all for your time. We happen to be in the other Washington while so much was going on in D.C. Still going on, indeed. There are just speeches happening right now at the Senate Judiciary Committee waiting for this vote at 1:30 p.m. today. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for listening. Enjoy your weekend, and we'll see you Monday from that other Washington. This is 1A.